Accession number 27303, Reel 4.
Mr. Harry Garrett, Reel 4.
And then we sort of were told to go, we had to go through to Catania after a while. We came back, as I said, for the very quickly, because it's all shale down. But I'd love to have had a camera with me then to take the site inside the craters up there, because when you get to the top of Etna, you see, you know, a bit more, and it's going up more, so you don't know if you're at the top or not. And then most eerily, it's always sort of misty over the top, and you see the planes going through at the top there, and they don't come down too low.
what planes were they? Did you
our own planes, yes, because we were in control of the island, except for the odd bit of bombing we got from the Germans, but very, very little, because we were just in complete control of the airfields there. On the plains before Catania, and we dug our trenches as best we could, but the whole area is all lava rock. And we had to dig ourselves as much as we could, but most of the trenches your cover was done by solid lumps of lava around your gun to stop the shrapnel hitting you or anybody around about, you see. So one day we got really heavily bombed and shelled by these Germans that are coming up there, and we were trying to get through to Catania, the whole division, and this bombardment, it was terrific, big guns, five, 9 shells, a terrific thing they are. And we got bung, and I thought, oh, thank heavens for our shelter. And suddenly we heard this one coming over about 50 yards away, and then straight away, bang! I thought, oh, God. And this is the one that had gone in my friend's trench, Kelly, Sergeant Kelly. He's a very nice chap, came from Oban in Scotland. And I say, we found bits as big as your thumbnail. Blown to smithereens, poor old Joe Kelly. He was a smashing guy. Why did this happen so many times, believe you me, during the war? Well, you know, the First World War, there's so many hundreds of thousands of unknown graves, aren't there?
That's right. People. But I mean, each time you must have been very choked and upset and affected by it.
Well, you do feel that way, and you pray for his soul, and then you've got to forget it, because if it gets on your mind, you can get more worried than you should be. I would think that the sadness I got when Diego got killed was, to me, very sad. The fact he hadn't died when I saw him left me open-minded, you know, but I knew he died. But old Kelly, and anybody near you, and because when you get a shell, this shrapnel shell, it tears the place to pieces. Oh, it's a bit worrying.
One thing I was going to ask you, you mentioned when you were up the top of Mount Etna that you left your battery sign.
Yeah.
What is your battery sign?
Well, it was my battery sign was a board with red and blue, which is the artillery colours, and a figure 3, which is the anti-tank regiment symbol. See, other units had a different sort of number up there, and this was there. And we, halfway up, I don't know if I mentioned it, halfway up, you come across a little tiny monastery place, and in that, it's all the graffiti on the walls of French, German, British, Italian, all scribed in this place. Is also a halfway stop, where they obviously stay there on the way, you know, to the top.
So could you look in that building?
Oh yes, quite well, quite well. it was almost a halfway stop, because you carried on from there to as high as you could, and then you suddenly come back. But say, it would be wonderful to have a camera there. Oh, fantastic.
It must have been very difficult getting down, though.
Oh, it was. Well, we just sort of, you see, you're travelling that way. We were skidding all the way. But you didn't dare go too fast, because if you didn't stop, you don't know where you end up. Dogs are not allowed at the table.
So from there, where did you head for?
Well, then it was up to, from there, it was through to Messina. That was our goal. And because the Americans were on our other side, they were going to the other side as we were coming up to Messina. And eventually, because we heard the war was over, that was fantastic. At least, it wasn't over, but the Germans, how they got back in such form, I wouldn't know. Because we had complete air cover. We had all the planes with the French, German, British and American planes, all the squadrons. We had everything going up for us. We couldn't lose. It was how Jerry got as many people away from Sicily, I would never know. You know, something went wrong somewhere.
Your next destination?
We had a bit of a holiday, and then I was given a detailed job of taking about 20 odd vehicles across to Naples from Messina, and so I was a sergeant in charge under an officer, and I had another bombardier with me, and we had to take these vehicles over. We went to Taranto, which is a big Italian naval port, up to Bari, where we refueled and got extra kit on board. And we travelled up all the way. And it was very like France in a way. All the bridges bombed and all the roads bombed and, you know, and all that sort of thing. There weren't the casualties down the back, because that was all over time we got through there, of course. And we got up as far as Bari and then up the top. And then we got to Naples, where I handed over our vehicles to the service corps that were there and took us all, and the guns that we had. We weren't, no personnel, because all the personnel had to come back with me, so we had about two vehicles full of men. And when we got to there, which was most amazing, on the way back, because there's a beautiful scenery there. You know, it's so beautiful, that country, Italy. Have you ever been to Italy?
I've only seen well through it.
Yeah, that place like Amalfi.
Went through Naples.
Like Amalfi and Naples and all those, and Sorrento, you know.
Mountainous?
Amalfi. Yeah. Amalfi.
Yeah, but you went, it's mountainous country, some of it.
Oh, yes, it's all mountainous country. Because we had a bit of trouble in the I didn't do any more fighting then. My job was just to do that and come back home. And we got within about 10 miles, 15 miles of Via Reggio, on the bottom of the toe of Italy, on the other side of Taranto. And suddenly my bomber said, "Look outside, you said there's a plane up there coming down." So we jumped out of this blooming truck on the 1500 weight Bedford. And suddenly all the cannons go boom, 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 boom. It came around a second time, straight through, straight in my vehicle. Up she went, bang, the lot, petrol, all the lot, all my loot. I had Beretta guns there, I had Lugers. I had two lovely silver shotguns, silver little shotgun, all my memorabilia, my baby, Johnny, and all my desert news and things I'd kept, you know, kept back what I could. Because being having a vehicle, you can keep a certain amount of stuff.
Letters.
All the whole lot went up then. Oh, yes. It was very sad, that was, because, you know, some photographs my wife sent to me and all these sort of things. Oh, dear.
You were?
Yes, yes. Frightened out of my eyes, actually. But I never forget, this is the most amazing thing. I wasn't scared. I wasn't hit. I got a vehicle and got back to Via Reggio, and I cannot remember that journey back to Via Reggio from the incident.
And how long would you say the journey was?
I wouldn't even know. It's just I cannot remember. I remember then getting on a boat and going back to Messina, but I cannot remember that journey. Well, I lost some memory of something through shock, I don't know, but I didn't think I was in shock.
Can I just tell you that I've interviewed three people who've had such experiences,
mm-hmm.
where they've got amnesia during, or they developed amnesia during a traumatic battle.
Could be. Maybe, I think I was a bit scared at the time when you get this, you get two runs of that Messerschmitt coming down, and I think, you know, but when it was all over, thank God he's gone, you know. But I'd love to have shot him down, but we didn't. He got away. But
So after that, were you back to Messina?
Back to Messina.
Yeah.
And then we had a couple of weeks' holiday, I suppose, getting ready, getting organised. And we went out in the Straits of Messina. And I swam nearly from Messina to Italy, but it's 2.5 miles across, you know. But every bit you go like that, the tide goes through, and you aim for that bit, and you keep going around like this. But and I was out there in the middle of the sea, and my other three sergeants were in a boat, and they were chasing and tailing me up, and suddenly shouted, "Sharks!" That made me frightened out of my life then. And of course the boat came round quickly and I jumped aboard, but they were dolphins. I didn't get in. I didn't make the coast, but I could have made it. I could swim about 8 miles in those days. I swim a couple of yards down there.
That's brilliant, 8 miles.
Yeah? Oh, yeah. Then, of course, we came back to England. And we got on this marvellous big boat, a smashing boat. It was one of the biggest turbo ships in the world at the time. Very comfortable. British Monarch it was called, I think, yeah. And we got back to England, and there again, wonderful thing. We were living my life with my darling wife again. Oh, dear. And then I got a job at Woolwich. I was graded down C, graded C, and I got a job of doing all the troops' forms when they retire from the army, you know, building them up to date and all this sort of thing. I was in charge of about six women clerks and my own men, and that was a good job there, because I was in charge of the rations as well, you see. And so when I got there, I just have to find that we got too much spam, so I had to make enough, I had to take home to my dear wife and family. But that was a wonderful, wonderful trip. And then, of course, I ended up but then going up to Woolwich B Battery, where I was taken over to take over with an officer. I had to bat. I had 20 batmen to look after these officers, to take them up in Catterick camp, up in Catterick. And we had to bat for them and do all the, you know, that we had to be trained into field gunners. From they were ship's officers. They had to be trained for field gunnery. But I didn't have too much to do with that. But I was in charge of the batman and the all the whiskey and the cigarettes and gin and all that horrible stuff, you know. And the officers were very kind. And every time they used to meet me in the bar, "Where's Sergeant? What would you like to drink?" I said, "Oh, Yes, I'll have a drink, sir. Can I put it down? Because I don't really want too much. That's all right, that's all right. Put it on my bill, you know. And I ended up by making some a bottle of whiskey a week and a bottle of gin a week, you know, just to take it out of the rations in. That was very good.
You'd had developed a little bit of skin problem, I believe.
Oh, yes. So when I got back there, I came back home, and then... No, I was in Catholic camp at the time, and I collapsed... No, this was before then, wasn't it? Of course it was. Yes, I got this skin trouble, dermatitis from a shave I had in Italy, I'm sure it was that. And at the same time, they were doing the penicillin treatment, trying it out. So I went to Harefield Hospital at Middlesex, and then they transferred me to the Shenley Lunatic Asylum. It's a bad word, lunatic. It wasn't called that, it was called a Shenley Hospital, well, obviously. To be a guinea pig for this penicillin, where every few hours they'd come round and get this perfume spray and squirt all round you. And I had a most marvellous beard because I wore a cheese cutter cap, you peek. This lovely beard, a marvellous beard. And eventually it all went away. But in the meantime, while I was there, because I saw another chap down at the bottom, and I went up to him, I said, how are you, mate? He said, oh, fine, it's fine. He said, where have you come from? I told him. I said, my name's Harry Gay. He said, my name's Peter Ustinov. I said, oh, Peter. I said, I've heard all about you. You're a bit of a guy, aren't you? I said, they told me you know all these languages and all. Yes, he said, I know 9 languages, he said. And was he a treat? What a treat he was. He was so exciting, you know, he made everybody laugh. And I'd love to get with it, kept with him. And I was so annoyed after the war. He did come to Sevenoaks, but I couldn't make it to see him. I'd love to have gone up to see him and said, do you remember these days, Peter? Because he keeps scratching his hand so it wouldn't get better. So he got his ticket, you see, in the end. And the good luck to him. And that's where I got my ticket too, the same thing. And they came back and I went up to them and they discharged me. And oh dear, what a wonderful time. I enjoyed the war in some respects, but it was very sad that the start of it was so uncomfortable. But of course we all did a good job. I think it was a united effort by all the Army, Navy and Air Force together, and no particular man did the job. We all did it together. That's the way I think it should be said.
Teamwork.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I know.
Have you, over the years, have you been affected by any bad nightmares or anything like that?
No, I was a bit when I first came back. I used to wake up with shock, you know, but not really seriously. And it never worried me too much. I took everything with a pinch of salt, which is something to say, I suppose, isn't it? I don't know. And I knew this had to happen, it did happen. And you got over it, and it was a wonderful feeling that you were still alive. That was a great thing, and you were looking forward to the future, which I'm now 86, and I suppose I've had a reasonable future.
Still looking forward to the future. I expect your faith must have helped.
I think so. I believe in God, and I prayed more than I ever needed to pray. Because of my dear wife and my son at the time, and my friends, and everybody was involved in my prayers, because I'm not a selfish man, and I like friends, I like people, and we're all together in that respect. But I do say I did a lot of praying. I still pray every day now, morning and night. Sometimes I forget now and again, you know, when I go to sleep halfway through it, but the intention's always there.
Also, you mentioned that you had a very happy marriage, so perhaps...
Wonderful girl, my wife. It was so sad that she had so much trouble. I mean, she had about 10 or 12 female operations for cancer and things like that. And she, how she got over this all in the end, I don't know. And she suddenly died of it. We went to a party across one of those houses over there one night, and she had about 3 whiskies, and she was as bright as a pin. And she came out, and that night I slept in the front room, and she slept in the back because she wasn't feeling very comfortable as many times. And about 1:30 in the morning, a big black cloud came over me. I shot out of bed and rushed in there quickly, and the dog came with me, jumped on the bed, and she just passed away then. And I did all sorts of resuscitation and rubbing her breast and kissing her and giving the kids a lie, but it was no good. She had gone straight away, so I stayed with her, must have been 3 or 4 hours. I thought I'd better ring the doctor, so I rang the doctor, and he did come round. He looked at me and he said, he didn't even touch my wife. He said, she's had a coronary. I said, what do you mean? He said, look at her face. And there was a going to heaven face, you know. And that's how she was. It was wonderful. Yeah, she was a darling. She was.
Blessed, though. Blessed.
Yeah, she's lovely. And it's, we've got four children, isn't it? And I've got 8 grandchildren. And, 12 grandchildren, 8 great grandchildren. So it's a big old family now. but never mind. Oh, yes. That was wonderful. My family had all grown up by then. At least not all grown up. This was. I don't know how long after the war. I know I had an Austin 10 car at the time. Must have been 1960-65, because I worked for the military firm. I worked before the war, and I was taken on as a traveller, and I got this car, and I suddenly said to my wife, I said, would you like me to go and see Evie's mother and father, dear? Because I said, he was such a nice lad. I said, I love that man. She said, let's go. So I said, okay. So I rang him up. I got through the directory inquiries. I got Ebenezer Lee, butcher at Chillingham. And away we went. There was my son, my younger son, my daughter, my elder daughter, myself, six of us in this little car. So we drove across to Tillingham, and I knocked on the door, and I said, Mr. Lee? Yes, he said. Oh, I said, I'm Harry Garrett. I said, I wanted to say to you that you had a wonderful son. I say, we nearly all got killed, but unfortunately Evie was the casualty that happened. I said, we got blown up very badly. I said, and that poor lad, I said, he was one of the bravest soldiers I've ever known, and he was the most helpful soldier I've ever known. He was my very great friend, and I said, I love that man. I said, and he was such a sad thing. Oh, he said, thank you so much. And his wife said, thank you for coming. We did so hope that we'd hear some news of him. And then I said goodbye, and then halfway back from Tillingham, I'm sitting there, my kids are screaming, the smoke's all coming out of the car. The HT lead on the battery had touched the coil, and it had burnt the coil out, and the smoke was coming through. Kids were screaming, we all jumped out of the car. I lifted the bonnet, I could see the disconnection, I undid the battery, and I called the AA out. And of course, in those days, you come up with a motorbike and sidecar, you know, salutes you in those days. And he said, your coil's gone. He said, I'll try and get you one, Mr. Garrett. You'll have to wait for a while, he said, because I'll have to go to Colchester. So away he went. About an hour later, he turned up. He said, I've got one for you. Oh, I said, that's marvellous. He put the coil in, everything under control, away we went. I said, how much is that? He said, give me 12 and 6, he said. 12 and 6. And I came back home. But it was so wonderful to see his parents. And then I went to a BBC trip to Dunkirk. And in one of the talks I've given over the air, it was about the Evie Lee business during there. And excuse me a minute, it's gone. So they gave out on this BBC, and they'd had a phone call from a lady. Would I be the Harry Garrett that was with Ebony during the war? And I said, yes. I said, I'm the same chap. Would you like to give the can I give them your phone number? I said, by all means. So I gave my phone number, and this dear lady rang me up, and she said, Harry, she said, we didn't know Ebby, we didn't know the mum and dad, but we are the nieces of the family. And we heard about your episode with the war, and we're absolutely thrilled the fact that you knew Ebby, because we're a great family, we're a loving family, he said, and we'd like to meet you. I said, that's pretty wonderful of you. I said, thank you very much. I said, but what can we do about it? Well, he said, we're getting the family together, and we will ring you up to tell you. We'll come down and take you out to lunch over at the pub across the road in the village of Riverhead. Oh, I said, that's marvellous. I said, we'd love to see you. So in the meantime, I'd got a Dunkirk Veteran Medal from a friend, for Ebenezer Lee, because he never had one given to him, because obviously he was killed. And so they came up this day, and the whole family came over. There was 13 or 14 of them. They'd come from Devon, Cornwall, Ipswich, and Tillow in Essex to come down to see me. Four cars on them were. And I was absolutely overwhelmed when they came down. And I said, oh, it's so great. I said, really, I said, it's wonderful. I said, because your nephew, I said, was one of the most marvellous fellows I've ever known. I said, because if you could love a man, I said, I love that man. I said, because of his help to me right through the war. And so I said, by the way, I said, I got this medal all polished up. I said, there you are. I said, now, will you please keep that as a souvenir of Ebby and Lee? Oh, so they're absolutely thrilled they were. So they came down, and that's a picture up there that they gave me as well at the time of Ebby. And then since then, I've had that other one of the farm and the building in it.
That's
and
the
outside, there's a picture, there's a war memorial, and Ebby's name's on it. You know, on that thing there. And I we keep in contact all the time. She rings me, I ring her, and how are you getting on? All the family keeps asking, how are you getting on? We thought we'd get in touch with you, and all that sort of thing. And we still keep contact, you know, just about once every 6 months or something. Send the Christmas cards, and they're awfully lovely, lovely family. They're thrilled. And they say, anything you want, anything you do, we'll do what we can for you. Oh, dear, you know, no problem. But you heard of comradeship, you see, and this is the sort of comradeship we had with Ebby, and if I'd have been wounded, he'd have done the same thing for me. This is the way I feel about it, and without any problems at all. And I mean, these are incidents that I did, and of course, I never mentioned this at all to anybody, what happened, because I didn't want medals or things like that, but that's the sort of thing you get a big medal for doing.
It's to me, it's just absolutely amazing heroism.
Yeah, you don't think about it. You just sort of, you know, that's your job. That's a great friend of yours, and you want to do what you can for him.
But the emotion that must have run through you when you knew, didn't you, that he was fatally wounded?
Oh, yes. It was, when I saw that wound, I couldn't believe it. If you've seen, there's nothing between his neck and his bottom, you know, and that's because he was leaning forward and the shell had gone in the back of the trench and blown out the back, you see. How he didn't kill him then, I don't know, because 88 millimetres is quite a big shell.
But while he was on your back during that fearful.
Yeah.
Because you were crawling, weren't
you? Oh,
yeah.
I couldn't tell you how I got over there. That's how I feel. It's a, I think you get a super, with a spirit in you or something, I don't know, you, extra strength, you fuss fine, and, well, obviously God gives it to you, doesn't he? Yeah. That you know that you're going to try and save that man, you see? And I'm sure he'd done the same thing for me, because he was such a guy.
During that, those terrible moments, were you aware of him speaking to you at all?
Oh, yes, he was moaning, but his first call was, oh, Harry, get that duvet off me. That duvet is a in the desert, you put a cover over the top of a trench to stop any aircraft seeing you, because it's all open, if it's clear at the top. And they call that a duvet, you see, the actual trench you're in. And this is what he said, get that duvet off me. He said, oh, it's hurting my back, it's hurting my back.
He must have been terrible.
And yet he was, you know, he was still talking quite calmly. Oh, yeah. Oh, no, he's a lovely man. He's a lovely man. But it's so sad when a guy like that dies. Because how would he have been? Well, he'd been 23, wouldn't he? You see, much too young. But he was a great... I think he was Jewish, I don't know. Ebenezer, I don't know. I don't know whether it's not an English name, is it?
I think it probably is Jewish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But because his father died, his mother died, and all that thing. And because I obviously lost check until that time, you see. But that's how it is, Polly, wasn't it? Hmm? Oh, but one more.